big shakeups at the top of two big companies.
But does a change at the top turn a firm's fortunes around?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Wednesday, September 7th.
Coming up, we'll continue our coverage on job creation and getting America back to work.
A lot of companies spent big on security after 9/11, but was all that money well spent?
And what is the coolest country in the world?
We'll give you a hint. It's not Canada.
Might be the coldest when it comes to temperature.
Maybe coldest, yeah, temperature-wise, but not the coolest, though. Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Now to the breakdown. Our economy, one step at a time, and Marketplace's special look at jobs and getting America back to work. And we're going to start now with the top jobs at a couple of big companies.
Yahoo, which has been struggling to compete with rivals Google and Facebook, has just fired its CEO, Carol Bartz. And Bank of America, which has been facing a drop in shareholder confidence, has just ousted two of its senior executives. Marketplace's Amy Scott joins us now to talk about what's behind these management shakeups. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Amy, does executive turnover mirror overall job turnover? In other words, are the people at the top as vulnerable in a weak economy as those in the middle and at the bottom?
Well, I wouldn't say as vulnerable, but certainly more so. I spoke earlier with Jeffrey Garten at the Yale School of Management, and he says, you know, there's so much uncertainty right now that he expects to see a lot more of this sort of thing in all sorts of industries.
I think we're going to see much shorter tenures at the top. And a lot of this is really not the fault of the leaders, but the extraordinary circumstances in which we find ourselves.
Extraordinary circumstances, Amy. And what about the effect of all of this? How effective is it when changes like this are made? Do CEO shakeups really turn things around at a company?
Well, short term, you might see, you know, a boost in the stock, as we did with Yahoo and Bank of America. But Garten says long term, you need a particular kind of leader in times like this, someone who's adaptable, entrepreneurial, maybe even ruthless, who can sort of steer the ship in a storm. And one example he gave is Steve Jobs, who really turned things around at Apple when he came back as CEO in the mid-90s. That was during a really rough time for the company. And, of course, Jobs just announced that he's stepping down again.
Indeed. Marketplace's Amy Scott. Thanks, Amy.
You're welcome.
Well, President Obama will outline his jobs program tomorrow night before Congress. Earlier this week in Detroit, the president gave a preview of that speech to a city and an area that is in a world of economic hurt. From station WDET, Quinn Kleinfelter reports.
In the parking lot of General Motors headquarters, Detroit resident Sheila Jackson is excited. She just saw President Obama address a crowd of thousands of union workers. But Jackson was let go from a car plant 2 years before Obama bailed out the auto industry.
There's been jobs, but if you're the lowest person on the seniority list, then if they lay off again, then you're the first person to leave. So you just have to keep trying to find something to do.
Jackson says she lost her home because she could not afford the mortgage and is trying to live with a diabetic condition without having any medical insurance.
Basically doing things that's better for my health so that I won't have to go to the doctor as much. But there's also a free clinic. If you pay $20, you can see a doctor.
Detroit's struggling economy hit public employees as well. Teacher Robert Brown likes President Obama's call to extend unemployment benefits and create new jobs by rebuilding America's crumbling infrastructure. But what Brown really wants the president to push for in his speech tomorrow is another round of federal stimulus funding.
And I'm not afraid to use the word stimulate, because that's exactly what we need. We've always needed it. The stimulus package just wasn't big enough because they didn't realize just how tough the recession was or is. So we need a massive plan.
Brown and others in Detroit are waiting to hear specifics about what Mr. Obama only hinted at on Labor Day and hope proposals like rebuilding bridges turn into concrete action. In Detroit, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter for Marketplace.
Well, now let's get some analysis on what President Obama might propose tomorrow night. Richard DeKayser is an economist with the Parthenon Group, and he joins us from Boston. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Richard, does it look, from what we know right now, like Washington is going to come together on some new jobs bill sometime soon?
Yeah, that's the way it's looking, and I think we're basically heading for a replay of where we were last year. After months of tough talk about reining in deficits and cutting spending, economic reality sinks in, disappointing numbers motivate Congress and the administration to act, and I think we're going to see another round of tax cuts or extending tax cuts that are otherwise set to expire, and maybe even some infrastructure spending increases.
Well, you mentioned the big tax cut package late last year. I mean, given where we are in our economy right now, does it really seem like that package worked?
I think it did. And more importantly, if you just ask the general question, have stimulus measures helped? The evidence suggests so. Now, don't take my word for it, but the Congressional Budget Office, which has a terrific track record for impartiality and objectivity, they've been focusing on the first stimulus legislation from back in 2009, and they recently put out a report on what would have happened just in the last quarter. And according to them, there are 1 to 3 million more jobs than would otherwise have been the case, and the unemployment rate is 1/2 to 1.6 percentage points lower than it otherwise would have been. So it could have been worse.
The theme of this year, and it seems like the last couple of years, could have been worse. Richard DeKayser, economist with the Parthenon Group, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Today, the House of Representatives looks at three trade deals with Colombia, South Korea, and Panama. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports on a plan that would help Americans who lose their jobs because of free trade.
Trade Adjustment Assistance, or TAA, gives extra support to people who lose their jobs because of competition from abroad. The support includes things like extended unemployment benefits and money for retraining and education. There are only about 250,000 participants, but for the last year, the TAA has been a source of tension between Republicans and Democrats. The program was expanded in 2009 to include service workers and more generous benefits, but that part of the program expired at the beginning of this year because of the political fight. Howard Rosen is a visiting fellow at the Peterson Institute, which is a think tank.
Since the beginning of this year, there has been a reduction in the number of people who are eligible for the program, removing the majority of service workers.
He says the TAA should really be a model.
It is precisely the kind of intensive assistance that's provided under TAA that we really should be providing all workers who are seriously unemployed.
But it's unlikely the free trade agreements with Colombia, South Korea, and Panama will get signed until Congress reaches a compromise on the TAA. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Well, more of our breakdown coverage is at marketplace.org. And, of course, later today on Marketplace with Kai Ryssdal. And, Steve, have you seen this Kai Ryssdal cutout that is floating around the office?
You are infatuated with the Kai Ryssdal cutout.
It's like even taller than he is.
It is.
He's a tall guy, but it's taller than he is. There's this cardboard cutout that's floating around.
You were putting it everywhere in the office the other day, just like in offices and in front of the window.
I put it right next to his producer, Megan Larson, right over her desk as he peered over her as she did her work.
It freaked her out, really, is what it did. And everybody else, too.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective on business and economics. A German court today ruled it was legal for Germany to help bail out European neighbors Ireland and Greece.
But as part of that ruling, it's now going to be harder for other countries who might be looking for financial help. Germany is Europe's biggest economy and so bears the biggest burden of a bailout. The BBC's Tristana Moore is with us now from Berlin. Hi, Tristana.
Hi.
Walk us through today's court decision in Germany. Who's claiming victory?
Well, I mean, I think the German government and the German Chancellor Angela Merkel are claiming victory because, after all, Germany's constitutional court upheld the legality of the German government's rescue packages for Greece and other countries in the Eurozone last year.
These are very unpopular bailouts, right?
Yeah, they're extremely unpopular. German taxpayers just can't understand why their money is being used to put the financial house in order of other countries' governments, which haven't really got their act together.
And what does this ruling, Tristana, mean for the debt crisis as a whole?
Well, I mean, markets have reacted very positively here so far. After all, the judges in Germany's highest court said that the billion-dollar rescue packages for Greece and other Eurozone members last year were compatible with German and EU law. But the judges did, however, say that in the future, the German parliament would have more say on other contributions to the Eurozone rescue schemes. So in actual fact, it could actually complicate negotiations over future crisis measures and may actually limit Chancellor Merkel's room for maneuver.
The BBC's Tristana Moore in Berlin. Tristana, thank you.
Thank you.
Now to the UK, which, just like us here in the US, is struggling with high unemployment. But there are differences. And here's reporter Christopher Worth on those differences between the U.S. and British job markets.
I meet Dilawar Hussein as he unlocks his bicycle outside this unemployment office in East London. He drops by every few days to apply for jobs. That is, since the garment shop he worked for went out of business. But after 6 months of looking, he's yet to receive a call.
That job situation is very bad at the moment. I am looking any kind of job, like cleaning, restaurant job, or handyman job, but I couldn't get anything.
And there are plenty more here like him. David Kern is chief economist at the British Chambers of Commerce. He says the number of people in the UK claiming unemployment benefits has recently seen its biggest jump since the darkest days of the crisis in 2009.
It's very tough out there, make no mistake about it. And it will get worse before it gets better because of the austerity plan that the government is implementing.
That austerity plan includes well over $100 billion in cuts to public spending. Kern says they're necessary, but it will push unemployment in the UK over 8% as hundreds of thousands of government jobs are cut. But Jim Bly of the Confederation of British Industry says even then, there are 500,000 vacancies in the UK waiting to be filled.
Lots of retailers are expanding. The agricultural industries are expanding as well. So most of the jobs at the moment are low-skilled.
Which means they're also low paid. But at least those jobs are projected to keep unemployment in the UK far below the 9.1% jobless rate in the US. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
Now to the troubles at the cash-strapped US Postal Service as it tries to cut costs and also ask its outside contractors to cut. Well, the Postal Service spends $15 billion a year with contractors, and it wants to bring that number down by a billion. Marketplace's David Gura reports from Washington.
The U.S. Postal Service has outsourced for a long time.
Probably since the Pony Express.
That's David Hendel, a lawyer with Hush Blackwell.
Mail that goes any kind of a distance at all has been contracted out from time immemorial.
To some familiar companies making hundreds of millions of dollars every year. FedEx and United Airlines, Northrop Grumman and IBM. Some of them transport mail, others help track it and sort it. Hendel says some of those contracts may not be renewed.
As the Postal Service contracts, it's buying less of everything.
And it's asking companies to consider lowering rates, to cut costs where they can. The Postal Service is asking for sympathy. But Hendel says the USPS will always rely on contractors. It's cheaper, and it doesn't have to worry about retirement or health care benefits. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Now to the high-stakes world of kindergarten,
what?
Steve. Yes, it's getting very high stakes these days. According to the New York Times, the Trinity School on the Upper West Side of Manhattan is so hard to get into that students that have no previous connections, like a sibling that went to the school or an alumni, a parent or something like that, they have just a 2.4% chance of getting into this school. The odds to get into Harvard are 6.2%. So it's actually three times easier to get into Harvard as it is
this
to get
is
into the Trinity School kindergarten class.
Wow.
And listen to the tuition at this place. $36,870 a year. For that, that's a lot of finger
paints.
That's
still a bargain, though, compared to Harvard. It could be a lot
true.
Worse, Jeremy.
Well, all this week, we're looking at how 9/11 has changed the landscape for American businesses 10 years on. And for companies large and small, spending on security continues to grow. But as Marketplace's Jeff Horwich reports, some have questions about whether that money is well spent.
Airlines? Sure. The Super Bowl? Naturally. Grain elevators? Say what? For you city folk, grain elevators are America's rural skyscrapers. Farmers dump their corn, wheat, and soybeans. Trucks haul it out to feed the country. Even though elevators are mostly in the middle of nowhere, Bob Zelenka of the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association says, you never know.
It's on the edge of town, so could somebody step in here and adulterate some grain? I guess it might be easy enough to do, but, you know, those are the kind of things we've changed in terms of locking down, which we never used to do, being, again, aware and vigilant.
9/11 meant new fences, lighting, training on what to do with suspicious requests for ammonium nitrate, a fertilizer that can be used to make a bomb. Many grain elevators also store farm chemicals. Zelenka says elevators are now required to track every kernel, where it came from and where it's going.
It's been thousands of dollars that elevators have spent. You take that times the 14,000 elevators nationwide, that's a big chunk of dough.
Too much dough, if you ask John Mueller. He's a professor at Ohio State and co-author of the new book, Terror, Security, and Money.
Maybe we're much overreacting and overspending for a threat which is extremely limited.
Mueller estimates the U.S. private sector spends at minimum an extra $10 billion a year on security since 9/11. From grain elevators to shopping malls, he says, rarely does the math make sense.
We've looked at the cost, for example, of protecting a large office building. The cost to retrofit a building to deal with, say, a truck bomb and so forth are not worth it unless the probability of the building being hit is 1,000 times higher than it actually is at present.
9/11 may have hit private businesses, but Mueller says nearly every foiled plot since then has had a government target, mostly military. As for grain elevators, Mueller says not a single case has targeted the U.S. food supply. Of course, this all makes sense on paper, but back at the elevator, Bob Zelenka says a different logic, 10 years on, continues to prevail.
You can't be too safe, I guess, these days, unfortunately.
In Vermilion, Minnesota, I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
Our look at the economic consequences of 9/11 continues tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report and right here on the Midday Update with the effects on the shipping industry.
New sentencing guidelines mean up to 12,000 new inmates around the country will be eligible for early release. Now, that means more people looking for work in an already strained job market. From St. Louis, reporter David Weinberg has more on some ex-cons who may actually have an advantage.
In St. Louis, your chances of getting a job are better if you've served time in prison. The unemployment rate in Missouri is 8.7%, but for former inmates, it's 7.9%, according to figures from the U.S. Probation Office.
In our opinion, employers that make a decision to hire formerly incarcerated individuals are really smart employers.
David Kessel is the Chief Operating Officer for Employment Connection. It's a St. Louis-based nonprofit that helps former inmates find stable employment. Kessel says one advantage to hiring former convicts is the $2,400 federal tax credit that companies get for every ex-offender they bring on.
Let's turn over to chronological resumes.
When the new sentencing guidelines go into effect, nearly 200 inmates in St. Louis will be eligible for release. Many of them will end up in this classroom.
Chronological resume is more so for people who tend to have a large number of jobs in a small amount of time, okay?
On a recent afternoon, roughly 40 people are attending this training class. Across the hall in the resource center, half a dozen ex-offenders are using computers to look up job listings.
Getting out of jail and trying to find a job, it's not going to be easy. It's really not. It's going to take from you a willingness to let go of the ghost that's going to haunt you, telling you that you can't do it because of this felon that you got.
Carl Washington served time for fraud, and he's one of Employment Connection's success stories. He recently landed a job working as a banquet server for hotels. David Kessel says if Washington stays employed, he's two-thirds more likely to stay out of prison. And that would save Missouri taxpayers a lot of money.
It costs anywhere from $15,000 to $30,000 a year to incarcerate an individual.
The new sentencing guidelines are expected to save the federal government $200 million in prison expenses in the first 5 years, but only if the inmates who are released stay out of prison. That's why several local governments around the country are looking at Missouri's success in keeping ex-offenders out of jail and fully employed. In St. Louis, I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
And finally, Jeremy, a new poll by social network Badu.com says, forget about the debt problems and so-called government dysfunction and 9% unemployment. American is still the coolest nationality in the world.
Oh, wow.
Being an American, Badu surveyed 30,000 people across 15 countries. Brazilians came in second. The Spanish came in third. They lead all of Europe.
See, those make sense, too. Everybody thinks Brazilians are cool, right?
I mean, well, you know, especially the Brazilians, right?
That's right.
And the Spanish think
and
the Spanish.
Yeah,
absolutely.
The siestas, those afternoon siestas, I think that's
well, no, that's
cool.
All in Europe. That's everywhere in Europe, not just in Spain. Come on. The least cool nationality, Jeremy?
Canadian?
No.
That was my first
You were hoping
guess.
For that, though,
no,
weren't
no.
you?
No, I love Canada. But what about Liechtensteinian?
Is that a nationality? Liechtensteinians?
Is that
no.
not it? No.
Belgians, the people
Aww.
Who live in Belgium.
Oh, but they've got such great chocolate.
They have great chocolate, and they have great waffles. And
waffles.
French fries. Well, fries. Frites, right?
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
Or frites.
Mm, I'm hungry. Yeah, why do we always good. End this podcast so hungry, Steve?
Because we've been working all night long.
Well, you can check out the list at the Marketplace Index section of Marketplace.org in Los Angeles. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. Enjoy your Wednesday. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.